of it. We find the ways and go on those ways collectively. I do not want to see 10th Muharram procession after the gap of 30 years suddenly come up as a procession not for Imam Hussein, but for the narrative building of a fake normalcy for Narendra Modi.
Locals too are apprehensive of this move amid the coronavirus pandemic.
Let them not play politics on this at least. This is a religious matter. If they think that allowing this procession will portray normalcy, they are risking lives. I don't think this was the right time to lift the ban. This simply means they don't care for the people.
After facing huge criticism, the government has revised the decision and passed the ball into the local administration's court. Since the decision of whether the Muharram procession be allowed or not has to be taken by district administrations, it remains to be seen how well they stage and whether people participate or not. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Few hours after President Qais Saied's decisions were published in the official gazette, Tunisian security forces arrested lawmaker Yassine Ayari to serve a two-month jail term handed down to him by a military court in 2018.
Everyone who erred must be held accountable, but a civilian may not be tried in a military court. Everyone who committed a crime must be arrested regardless of the circumstances of the trial.
Judge Bashir Al-Akrami was placed under house arrest after being accused of covering up terror-related files, obstructing investigations into them, and violating the law regarding the files of political assassinations. Hours later, security forces raided homes of other lawmakers to implement rulings issued by the military judiciary, including Muhammad Al-Afis, Saifuddin Makhlouf, Abdul Latif Al-Alwi, and Maher Zaid, who was arrested and then released.
May God bless the president. We thank Qais Saied. We thank him for the decisions. Poverty and unemployment have overwhelmed us. I'm a Tunisian woman begging for money to buy medicine, and even my husband's salary has been seized.
About lifting the immunity of the deputies, I neither agree to nor oppose the decision. I support the enforcement of law.
On August 2nd, Tunisian security forces arrested Member of Parliament Faisal Tibini under summons issued by the first instance court in the state of Jandouba. Tibini was charged with spreading false news and offending others through social media. He also faces three other similar charges. Raids and arrested lawmakers to implement rulings issued by the military judiciary have opened the door to accusations against Saied, while leading political parties in Tunisia accuse the president of orchestrating a coup. Rights activists are concerned that the measures could open the door to further violations of citizens' freedoms.
Raids, arrests, and placing a deputy in prison to implement a ruling issued by the military judiciary opened the door to accusations against Saied, leading political parties in Tunisia accuse him of a coup. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
Following the latest Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip that left more than 200 people dead, including women and children, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still recovering the psychological consequences of the war. Almost 600,000 students have suffered a significant learning loss. In conjunction with the announcement of the Palestinian high school Tawjihi scores, 18 students from Gaza are not around to receive their scores as they were killed by the Israeli airstrikes. Khalid Al-Qanoua, a Palestinian student who was supposed to be receiving his high school scores this year, was killed by the Israeli airstrikes, leaving his family grieving.
I remembered Khalid today when I saw other students. Khalid was supposed to be with us today, celebrating his success and distributing sweets like other people. I saw Khalid's mates when they were having their exams, and I felt happy that Palestinians still insist on living their life even after wars and losses. I wish Khalid was here, but I believe that by knowledge, Palestinians will take revenge for Khalid, and his death won't go in vain.
The release of the test scores is usually met with parties, fireworks, and gifts. But due to the crisis in Gaza, many Palestinian students are not celebrating their success.
I have 3 of my sons who finished high school, and we celebrated with them. There were always atmospheres of happiness when my son succeeded. I wish Khaled was here so we could celebrate with him. He would have been something important. This time, the Israeli occupation stole my happiness. I feel it's lost in all ceremonies. Whatever the Israeli regime does with its crimes and killings, we will remain patient and we won't give up this land.
Subhi Abulauf, who has lost most of his family members in the Israeli airstrikes, is also among the students who were deprived from pursuing high school, as he is traumatized by his loss.
هذه بصراحة لحظات صعبة بالنسبة لي كتير.
Those are really hard times for me while students are happy for their success being around their families. I've lost my mom, my sister, and my home, and I couldn't continue going to school. There is no place for happiness. My cousin and I were supposed to be celebrating like our mates, but Tawfiq and my family are not around, and I'm not capable of continuing my education.
Many Palestinian students in the Gaza Strip who have lost their homes and family members are not able to carry on with the test for the time being due to the state of depression and instability they are in following the war over Gaza. Roba Shavit, Gaza.
A tearful farewell to Craig Murray from his family and supporters as the 62-year-old former diplomat hands himself in to Edinburgh police. In May, Scotland's second most senior judge accused Mr. Murray of deliberately risking jigsaw identification, an obscure term meaning if pieced together, his posts could have led readers to identify women who made sexual assault allegations against former Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond, a charge Murray denies. But the UK's Supreme Court refused to hear his appeal last week.
This is an absolute disgrace. If they had to punish him, which I don't think they should have, because the evidence and the charges were so tendentious and so tenuous, they could have put him under home arrest or house arrest, put him on a tag. And if that wasn't enough, at least put him in an open prison. He is not a threat to society. The people who put him in prison are.
Mr. Murray is not only known for his Alex Salmond blog posts. The independent blogger is a dedicated defender of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in a UK maximum security prison. After his sentencing in May, Murray released this tweet saying he had been banned by judges from traveling to Spain, where he was to give evidence in a criminal prosecution over CIA spying activities against Assange.
He's been a great comrade of Julian Assange. I myself have been privileged to share platforms with Craig at Julian Assange solidarity meetings, and I can tell you he is becoming more and more popular. And what they have done in their infinite stupidity, the people behind this decision, that includes the Supreme Court in London, which refused to hear an appeal against the original sentence in the Scottish courts. What they have done, they've made him into a martyr. And when he comes out of prison, he will come out much stronger, and they will be much weaker for it.
Craig Murray became the UK's ambassador to British ally Uzbekistan in 2002, but was removed from his post only 2 years later, after his revelations on human rights abuses and torture in the former Soviet Republic became an embarrassment to the British government.
Craig Murray was part and parcel of the establishment, but rose against it. Campaigners say his incarceration, the first in this country in 50 years over a media contempt case, is political and sets a dangerous precedent for freedom of speech and independent journalism. Saeed Pariza, London.
After winning the presidential election in June, Ibrahim Raisi now receives the presidential mandate from leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And this means Raisi is endorsed by the leader to be the new Iranian president. The decree was read out during the ceremony. It contains instructions and guidelines by Ayatollah Khamenei about major issues the president needs to address in his tenure. During the ceremony, Ayatollah Khamenei hoped the new administration will solve the existing economic problems in the country. Former President Hassan Rouhani handed over power to his successor with a pile of incomplete political and economic tasks on the table, from snowballing inflation to the unconcluded nuclear talks with world powers. Ibrahim Raisi vowed to adopt a better approach toward those issues, a new approach that would remove U.S. sanctions and improve people's livelihood.
Change is what our people demand from the new government, and this change is inevitable. People's livelihood has been damaged, and they have lost their trust in the government because of the economic woes. My administration will try to lift sanctions, but we will not tie people's livelihood to the West.
Raisi won the 13th presidential election by a landslide on June 18th. He is affiliated with the Principalist camp, which adopts a hard line regarding the U.S. and believes negotiations with American officials would be futile, since they're not trustworthy.
Under the Iranian constitution, any president-elect needs to have the endorsement of the leader before assuming office. Without it, their presidency would be null and void. And now that Raisi is granted the leader's mandate, Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Guantanamo Bay, where U.S. officials claim to be used as a detention facilities for hundreds of the most wanted terrorists on the earth, mainly Al-Qaeda and Taliban members. But there were dozens of prisoners who were not terrorists, but freedom seekers who were following their goals via peaceful attempts. The late Dr. Sayed Muhammad Ali Shah Mousavi Gardizi, or the prisoner number 1154, was one of them. He was brutally tortured by the U.S. forces during his nearly 4 years of detention in U.S.-run Guantanamo Bay. The late Gardizi was known as a popular political, cultural, and social figure in Afghanistan. He, along with 35 others, lost their lives 3 years ago after two Daesh terrorists detonated their explosive belts among them during Jumu'ah prayers in a mosque in Gardiz, the capital city of southeastern Paktia province. Now, along with the arrival of the third martyrdom anniversary of the late Gardizi and 35 of his relatives, this webinar is launched to pay respect to him as a great man, as well as to review the American model of human rights and democracy. In the eyes of the attendees of this webinar, the U.S. just follows its own geopolitical goals under different slogans. And when it comes to dealing with anti-arrogance figures like the late Gardizi, and then this is American gun that operates instead of law, regulation and humanitarian values.
The United States claims it's defending human rights, but persons like Dr. Sayed Muhammad Ali Shah had neither held weapons nor committed any attempt against our national interests. He just sought to provide services to his own people and carry out intellectual and cultural activities.
The Americans did not come to Afghanistan to build a nation. Their main goal was to keep a close eye on the regional countries, mainly the U.S. rivals, including China, Russia, and Iran. Slogans such as human rights and democracy serve only as a tool at the hand of the U.S. to pursue its geopolitical goals.
It seems that the late Gardizi had already realized that the American model of human rights and democracy have no place in Afghanistan. That is why he seriously resumed his cultural and social activities in his hometown, Gardiz, after he was released from Guantanamo Bay.
The moves that the U.S. and NATO pursued under the guise of human rights and women's rights were often at odds with the country's indigenous culture. Later, all Afghans, mainly well-known figures like the late Gardizi, realized that the U.S. has been working for its own interests.
In the meantime, the attendees of this webinar insist on following the path of great figures like the late Gardizi as the symbols of strength, resistance, and freedom-seeker leaders. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
application on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Ebrahim Raisi took oath of office as the 8th Iranian president. Attended the ceremony in the Iranian parliament where ranking international figures, including dozens of heads of state and dignitaries. Addressing the ceremony, Raisi took pride in the chance he was given by the people to serve the nation at a critical juncture. He spoke of a new era of change during which people's livelihoods will be improved, corruption and discrimination will be fought, and justice will be promoted. He also insisted that the anti-Iran sanctions be lifted.
Ebrahim Raisi was sworn into office as Iran's new president, with the prospect of change and resolutions to make Iran a better place to live. 115 heads of state and political officials from 73 countries attended the inauguration ceremony held in Iran's parliament on Thursday. With Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohseni Eji on his side, Raisi pledged to protect the constitution and to serve the country and the Islamic establishment.
I, as president, swear to God Almighty before the Holy Quran and before the Iranian nation that I will safeguard the country's official religion and the establishment of the Islamic Republic and the country's constitution.
Ebrahim Raisi won the 13th presidential election on June 18th with a landslide, garnering 64% of the votes. His predecessor, Hassan Rouhani, left office with a pile of unresolved political and economic issues on the table, from snowballing inflation rates to the unconcluded nuclear talks with world powers. The 8th Iranian president vowed to fix all those issues, but he said he will not tie the country's economy to the nuclear deal.
Sanctions against the Iranian nation must be lifted. I will support any diplomatic process that would fulfill this goal. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic of Iran regards its neighboring countries as its kin. So our first and foremost priority will be to upgrade our ties with our neighbors.
As has been the custom for any incoming administration, Raisi was endorsed by Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei on Tuesday. Now, after taking the oath of office, Raisi will have to name his cabinet members, who will then show up here in Majlis for a vote of confidence from lawmakers.
Coming from the principalist camp, Ebrahim Raisi holds different, if not opposing, views compared to his pro-reformist predecessor, Hassan Rouhani. So something like clinching a deal with the U.S. as the ultimate way out for Iran's ailing economy is not expected to be on top of his agenda. As the new president says, he will find new destinations to fix the economy. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian parliament in Tehran.
Hello and a warm welcome to the show. I'm Behruz Najaf. In the spotlight is Iran's new president taking oath of office. To discuss related issues, I will be joined by political commentator Marhan Abedin in our studios in Tehran. And also political analyst and professor at the University of Tehran, Fuad Izadi in Tehran. Good to have you both with us in the show. Let me start with Mahan in our studio. Mahan, among the foreign officials participating in the swearing in ceremony here in Tehran just a few hours ago, as you witnessed, were figures from Palestinian, Lebanese, and also Yemeni's resistance group. What does this signify?
Well, it's clearly very important. It shows that support for the resistance axis and for resistance groups across the region is now, you know, foremost at the top of the priority for Iran's incoming administration under President Raisi. Mm-hmm. Iran is going to prioritize supporting these groups at ideological and political levels, at material levels. And it shows that Iran is not going to shy away from, you know, the foundational aspects of its foreign policy, which is to support resistance against occupation, against imperialism, against domination-seeking powers in the region and beyond. And I think, obviously, the visual was very striking. The symbolism is very important. But I think in the months and years ahead, you're going to see, you know, practical policies in place to support these groups more and more. Now, one criticism that's often been leveled at the outgoing administration, or the former administration, now President Rouhani, was that it didn't give sufficient credence or sufficient support to the resistance axis, that the former administration prioritized relations with the West at the expense of, you know, Iran's organic and very deep links to resistance groups across the region. I think the administration that took charge today is going to reverse that policy, mm-hmm. hence that very striking visual of the resistance leaders sitting actually in front of the EU envoy that had come to the ceremony. Very striking imagery indeed.
Right. Okay, let me turn to Professor Izadi. Good to have you with us. President Raisi stressed in his inaugural address that Iran will continue to stand by the oppressed people of the world, no matter where they are, be it in Europe, in America, in Africa, in Syria, in Yemen. Let's have your comment on that.
You know, Mr. Raisi belongs to this liberation theology school of thought within Shia Islam, the same school of thought that Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, belonged to. And in that version of Shia Islam, you have the cleric that feel responsible to the poor and to the oppressed. And since Islam is a universal religion, this caring for the poor and the oppressed is not bound by borders. So whether they are, as Mr. Raisi said, in Europe or United States or Latin America, the concern for that segment of society is part of Dr. Raisi's worldview. And that's the basic idea that is also present in Iran's constitution. And as you know, today was the ceremony that Dr. Raisi promised to implement the constitution. So all Iranian presidents basically needed to have that worldview, since they needed to follow the articles of the constitution. And as we know, not all of them necessarily cared about that aspect of constitution in the degree that was expected. Mm-hmm. In the previous years, we have had presidents that cared less, and then I think Dr. Raisi is going to be a president that's going to care more about this.
Maybe they care, but they didn't implement it anyway. Okay. And Mohan, President Raisi said that foreign pressure and sanctions will not stop Tehran from pursuing its what are called legal nuclear rights. Do you think Tehran will give in to U.S. pressure?
Yeah, I think that was one of the more important features of President Raisi's speech. It's really important because it shows, you know, it's demonstrative of a shift in attitude and by extension a change in policy. Unlike the previous administration, Iran is not going to suspend its economic development and its engagement in the world, you know, on the condition of restoring the JCPOA in full or pursuing deeper relations with the West. Iran is going to follow its an activist and expansive foreign policy, engage powers and countries across the world, including notably in Asia and notably with China. You know, the fact that sanctions are in place is not going to deter the country from developing its economic resources. Now, the previous administration arguably did not even believe in the concept of a resistance economy. Mm-hmm. Hence, they never really took any serious steps in trying to implement it. I think by stark contrast, President Raisi is a firm believer in the whole concept and philosophy of a resistance economy, of self-sufficiency, of developing, you know, internal resources and internal capabilities. So you're going to see very firm policies in that regard in the months and years ahead. And this is really important if Iran is going to fully circumvent the sanctions regime. Now, I believe that we have, we have passed the worst of these sanctions. Iran successfully defeated Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign, which even according to the Americans was the most harshest sanctions policy ever imposed on a country. Iran proved its resilience. It defeated that campaign. Sanctions are going to remain. We defeated Trump, so, you know, surely we can defeat Biden, which is a weaker version of Trump. And I think the resistance economy is going to be the centerpiece to that. And that is really arguably the most important feature of President Raisi's speech, at least from my point of view, that we are not going to wait for the Americans to lift these sanctions. We are going to fully defeat it and circumvent it by ourselves.
Okay. Now, Fuad Izzadi, the new Iranian president also stressed that he'll be extending a hand of cooperation to all countries, especially neighboring countries, and which he called Iran's next of kin. How significant could this policy be, and what could we expect to happen?
You know, I think this is quite significant, and it's a departure from Iran's foreign policy, starting from Mr. Rafsanjani's tenure as president about 30 years ago. When you look at what Iranian presidents used to care about in foreign policy during Rafsanjani administration or Khatami administration or Rouhani administration, and even Ahmadinejad's administration towards the end, was resolving the dispute with the West. That was their first priority. And they didn't get much out of that desire. And if you look at sanctions, the sanctions continue to increase. And Western countries, especially the United States, seem to care less about the desires of Iranian presidents to reduce tension with the West. And this is what we recently witnessed with Trump leading the nuclear agreement. And Biden has been in office for 7 months now, and he does not seem to be wanting to go back to the agreement because they are putting sentences in the Vienna talks that are not part of the agreement. They seem to be wanting to change the nuclear agreement. So given that history, Mr. Raisi is presenting a new path that resolving problems with the United States is not going to be his first priority in foreign policy, since he realizes that the sanctions are going to be with Iran for some time to come, going around sanctions and working with neighboring countries and the countries that like to work with Iran to basically improve Iran's economy under sanctions is going to be his priority. And he realizes that not all countries in the world are Western, and a lot of Iran's neighbors already are engaging Iran economically. He is going to try to improve economic relations with the neighboring countries. And as you know, in the last number of months, Iran has signed a 25-year agreement with China. Iran is developing its relations with Russia. Iran is also looking at going beyond the neighborhood and looking at countries in Latin America and Africa.
Right.
So overall, the policy, you're seeing a paradigm shift in Iran's foreign policy, and that's going to be something new, and that's going to be something that's going to be tested for the first time in the last 30 years.
Right. Mohan, as Professor Izzedi mentioned, we just started mentioning the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, and President Raisi said that the sanctions must be lifted, and that he said he'll try his best to do that. And, the Vienna talks kind of stalled. They were waiting for a new administration to take the helm. Now we have the new administration taking office very soon, as the Parliament Speaker promised will happen even sooner than maybe the two-week legal period. So which direction do you expect the so-called Vienna talks and reviving the JCPOA to go with a new administration from Iran going to continue with the negotiations?
Well, President Raisi said he will utilize all diplomatic tools to get sanctions lifted. So presumably that means engaging with the Vienna process. But I think the approach is going to be different to the previous administration. Possibly radically different. There's going to be an attitudinal shift. Look, the policy is the same. Iran wants engagement. Iran wants sanctions lifted. Mm-hmm. And Iran wants full compliance to the JCPOA by all parties, notably the U.S., which unilaterally withdrew in May 2018. So I think Iran will have a tougher attitude to the negotiations. The bottom line has to be met, and the bottom line has been set by the leadership and also by the Supreme National Security Council. Foremost, sanctions have to be verifiably lifted. Now, it doesn't matter if they're all lifted in one go or sequentially, as long as they are verifiably lifted. And Iran will only go back into full compliance with the JCPOA once those sanctions have been lifted. There's not going to be any follow-through talks because the U.S. is keen to engage Iran on more expansive issues, for example, our policy in the region, our defensive capabilities. They have nothing to do with a nuclear deal. And also, there has to be some form of guarantee that another U.S. administration is not going to breach its commitments like the Trump administration did and to leave the deal. So if this bottom line is met, there can be a deal tomorrow. And if the Americans are sincere, this is actually an opportunity for them because there's a new Iranian government in place. There's a new reality. Iranian foreign policy, especially at a regional level, is going to be more assertive. I think foreign powers, the leading Western powers, US, UK, France, Germany, all the key stakeholders in this region, they need to realize that Iran is not going to be a diffident player in the region anymore. There's going to be an assertive, self-confident foreign policy. Now, on that basis, there's plenty of room for engagement and dialogue with the U.S. But really, what Iran is asking for is not much. It's really the JCPOA in its original form. And let's be clear, over the past 2 years, since Iran has been pulling back from some of its commitments, it's been doing this within the framework of the JCOA, right. JCPOA. Iran has never violated the JCPOA. Mm-hmm. That's very important. There are stipulations that it allows one of the signatories to pull back on their commitments if others violated, and the Americans have violated the deal. So to answer your question, I think we're going to have more negotiations as part of the Vienna process, but much more goal-orientated. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is possibly one of the last chances for the U.S. to strike an honorable deal with Iran on this issue.
Now, let me put almost the same question to Professor Izzetti. What sort of policy would you expect the White House to adopt vis-a-vis this new administration that Iran is that's going to represent Iran in the Vienna talks? The U.S., as you know, so far under the Biden administration, has not been ready to provide any guarantee that Iran is asking for, not to scrap the deal again like his predecessor, and no sanctions are lifted practically. So what do you expect to happen next?
You know, another problem that exists with U.S. demand is that they want to put a sentence in the Vienna talk communique, if an agreement is reached, that Iran needs to commit to further talks. And as we know, every time American officials talk about the nuclear agreement, they use this terminology of longer and stronger. By longer, they mean they want to change the articles of the nuclear agreement, the sunset clauses that are going to end in 8 years or 10 years or 15 years after the start of the agreement, that they want to extend those years, and that's what they mean when they talk about having a longer agreement. And a stronger basically means that they want concessions from Iran on non-nuclear issues, on Iran's defense policy, Iran's missile capabilities, Iran's foreign policy, regional policy, Iran's links with resistance organizations throughout the region. And this is not acceptable to Iran. And that's one of the reasons we haven't seen the seventh round of talks, is the U.S.'s insistence on changing the JCPOA and adding other stuff to it that is not part of the original text. So what's going to be the future? It very much depends on the United States. If they want to keep on demanding unrealistic things from Iran, then you're not going to see an agreement. If they realize that pushing Iran that far is going to result in the failure of the talks in Vienna, then they may reconsider. It is in the interest of the Raisi administration to reach an agreement with the other side, given the fact that Iran's economy is not doing that well. They do need sanctions relief, but they actually want to see sanctions relief. They don't want to enter a process of just giving concessions and not seeing much out of the talks. They don't want to see a repeat of the nuclear agreement that was signed in 2015, where they get a little bit of relief and then someone comes by and just leaves the agreement, and then the new people want to play
and
around with
more
the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And then put more sanctions on Iran, and you don't have to wait for 2024 to see the nuclear agreement in jeopardy again if some Republican president is elected. We have the congressional elections next year, 2022, and every other week we have these Republican senators writing to Biden saying that they are going to leave the agreement, whatever agreement Biden makes with Iran, if they don't like it, if they become the majority party in the U.S. Congress. So overall, Americans have a saying, you fooled me once, shame on you. You fooled me twice, shame on me. Iran doesn't want to be fooled twice by the United States.
Okay. Now, Mohan, one last question. The economy definitely will take center stage in the new administration by Mr. Raisi. So what does it take for the Iranian economy to flourish and go back on the right track. We have only 1 minute.
Well, as I said, the guiding philosophy of the new administration is going to be the resistance economy, of actually relying more and more on indigenous resources to push the economy through. But also at the forefront of President Raisi's priorities will be to fight corruption. Corruption not only in the sense of, you know, financial misdemeanors, but getting the bureaucracy, the government apparatus into shape, making it more efficient. And this in turn will start to improve the economy. But I think more broadly, it's a case of establishing, you know, confidence in the country, building up the people's confidence. Mm-hmm. People are generally very despondent right now in terms of their job prospects, in terms of their broader economic prospects. And he really needs to give people that boost. And I think the first 100 days will be crucial in terms of just setting in train the actual atmospherics of his presidency. Mm-hmm. Now, the real policies, you know, they will take months and years to take shape and to implement.
Okay, and then we come to the end of this spotlight edition. Let me thank our guests. We had political commentator Mohan Abed in our Tehran studio, and also political analyst and professor of the University of Tehran, Fuad Izzedi, in Tehran, with our comments and contributions.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Social media platforms are accused of collaborating with the Israeli regime to silence Palestinian voices, says Omar Karmi, writer, in an article published under the heading, Why Did Scientific American Censor Gaza Solidarity Call? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. On June 2nd, not long after the cessation of the Israeli regime's May assault on Gaza, Scientific American published an opinion article titled, As Healthcare Workers, We Stand in Solidarity with Palestine. The article was an argument that, as part of their responsibility for the well-being and sustenance of all human life, U.S. healthcare workers should feel free to speak out about Palestine. It further argued that those in the field should endorse the standards set forth by the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS. We must honor the fundamental responsibilities conferred through our oath and our core bioethical principles by individually and collectively demanding accountability and an end to all forms of oppression from the Israeli regime, as well as from our own countries and institutions upon all Palestinian people. It lasted 9 days. On June 11th, the article was taken down from the Scientific American website after editors apparently decided that the article fell outside the scope of the magazine, an explanation that left readers and authors nonplussed. It was left to the New York Post to report that the article was swiftly retracted after a letter to the editor signed by more than 100 scientists, among them three Nobel Prize winners. Such an effective response from pro-Israeli regime academics might have been predicted. Steve Rose, a neuroscientist, emeritus professor at Open University and co-founder in 1969 of the British Society for Social Responsibility in Science, said, "I am not surprised. I know very, very well and painfully the huge pressure that can be put on by the Israeli counter-boycott effort." In 2014, he was one of the original signatories to a letter to the British medical journal, The Lancet, protesting the Zionist regime's devastating assault on the Gaza Strip that year that left more than 2,200 people dead. The publication of that letter was met by a storm of protest from pro-Israeli regime scientists around the world and resulted in threats being leveled at the journal's editor and his family. Such pressure has had a lasting effect. Last year, The Lancet pulled another letter calling on the Israeli regime to end the siege on Gaza because of the blockade's efforts on healthcare in Gaza generally and the struggle to combat COVID-19 specifically, and after a similar campaign against the journal. And with social media platforms accused of collaborating with the Israeli regime to silence Palestinian voices, not least during May's assault on Gaza, pressure on platforms that carry viewpoints challenging the Israeli regime's official discourse remains considerable and influential. The Israeli regime is prepared to spend millions on countering BDS, Stephen Rose pointed out, referencing the task force in Israeli regime's strategic affairs set up for that specific purpose. Scientific American did not just remove the article. The headline was changed, removing the word solidarity and changing Palestine to Palestinians. No notice was given to the authors. "We were not warned before it was taken down," said one of the authors who asked not to be named for this article, nor were the writers informed of the headline change. "Until now," the author told the Electronic Intifada, "we have yet to receive any explanation for why it was taken down." Scientific American declined to provide further explanation. A spokesperson would only offer a similar rationale to that posted online, that after publication, it was decided that this opinion and analysis piece fell outside our scope of coverage. The magazine owned by Springer Nature, in which the German family run, Holt Spring Publishing Group holds a majority share, would not be drawn on whether this was due to outside pressure. The New York Post did publish extracts from the letter it said had been sent to Scientific American to protest the article. The letter writers, who included Stanley J. Robey of Duke Cancer Institute and Edward C. Halprin, Chancellor of New York Medical College, described the original article as a one-sided invective. While purporting to be a scientific statement about public health, the paper addressed important historical and political issues superficially, inaccurately, and prejudicially, the letter read, as reported by the New York Post. In reality, the piece is a call for activism that, in our view, is unsupported by the facts, unquote. One such fact, and one of the biggest sticking points, according to New York Post, for the eminent but angry letter writers to the Scientific American, was that the original article had omitted to mention that under the 1993 Oslo Accords, the Palestinian Authority was responsible for providing health care to Palestinians. That argument has been trotted out several times by the Israeli regime's defenders as a way to excuse the Zionist regime's refusal to provide vaccines to Palestinians in occupied territory in the battle against the spread of COVID-19, and generally let
the Zionist regime off the hook for its control over the Palestinian health sector, especially in the Gaza Strip, which has been under the Zionist regime blockade for 15 years and suffers a chronic shortage of essential medicines as a direct result. It ignores several facts about the Zionist regime's occupation. The PA is in full civilian control of only some 40% of the occupied West Bank and has no control over borders or imports. The Zionist regime restricts all goods that come in and out of the Gaza Strip, meanwhile including medicines and medical equipment. And finally, as has been pointed out by several human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Beth Salem, the Oslo Accords do not supersede the Zionist regime's obligations under the Geneva Conventions, under which an occupying power has ultimate responsibility for the health of the occupied population. The angry but eminent letter writers to Scientific American may not agree that the Zionist regime should bear responsibility for the Palestinian health sector. That it does, however, is an entirely logical inference based on international law and the reality on the ground. None of the authors of the original piece have seen the letter of complaint that was reportedly sent to Scientific American, but the fact that the article came down without any indication from the editors that there was unease about the article prior to publication suggested that the weight of external political forces had been brought to bear. The decision of the editors to remove our article serves as one of many examples of outright censorship of scholarship and advocacy dedicated to ensuring Palestinians have adequate access to health care and a right to live in freedom, the authors told the Electronic Intifada. The climate around public discourse on the Israeli regime and the U.S. and Europe is laughably fraught. Even the decision by an ice cream company to not sell its products in illegal Israeli settlements in occupied territory has been described as a new form of terror. In the less emotive environs of scientific and academic journals, the idea that science should somehow stay above the political fray is one that is often used to criticize attempts at invoking the social responsibility of scientific and academic communities. But Stephen Rose argued those arguments are usually fraught with inconsistency. Moreover, with the apparent targeting of Palestinian healthcare professionals and facilities, politics is clearly encroaching on science and academia, in this case, healthcare workers. Those of us who work in healthcare understand well that healthcare does not exist in a vacuum, the original article reads. We increasingly understand how structural forces systematize and institutionalize oppression, racism, violence, disinvestment, and displacement, as well as policies meant to deny people their basic human rights, lead to adverse health outcomes and mortality. If we remain silent on these issues, the article concluded, it is due to our own positions of privilege and relative safety.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.